From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
Video games are an $18 billion industry in the U.S., and they just keep growing. Will Hollywood studios get in on some of that interactive action? Plus, will TV's increasingly pilotless way of making shows crash and burn? But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere, it's The Business from NPR. It's the attack of the meaningless techie names. Hulu? Vuzu? Voodoo? Going cuckoo over which does what for who? Fear not. We will tell you. First, Hulu. It's the online joint venture of Fox and NBC that streams free Hollywood entertainment. It launched last week as the anti-iTunes, with about 250 TV episodes and 100 movies from some 50 partners. Hulu's free, in the sense that no money leaves your wallet, but you do pay by watching ads that can't be zapped. Happily, the commercials are shorter and less frequent than on regular network television. Meanwhile, last week, Paramount Pictures launched Vuzu, a free Facebook application that allows you to grab a clip from just about any Paramount movie for your viewing and sharing pleasure. Where's the money in that, you ask? Well, they hope to add ads to the service in the near future, and the Vuzu clips include a link to Amazon.com, where users can then buy the movie they just saw on DVD. And DVD brings us to Voodoo. That's V-U-D-U, the anti-DVD. Voodoo is a slick little box that delivers instant access to more than 5,000 high-def movies for rental, purchase, or both, with no monthly fees. It works directly through a high-speed internet connection and plugs into your TV, but you don't need a computer, cable, or satellite TV service. Last week, the little-known but extremely cool little device dropped its price by $100 to $295. We expect a lot of people to start practicing Voodoo very soon. Regardless of whether you Hulu, Voodoo, or Vuzu, it's clear that Hollywood is rapidly becoming what oddsmakers like to call a zero-sum game. That is, for every bite that goes digital, an equal bite seems to be taken out of old media. Both cannot grow at the same time. For proof, just look at the books at the Walt Disney Company. Last week, CEO Bob Iger told analysts at the annual Bear Stearns Media Conference in Palm Beach, Florida, that he expects to collect $1 billion in revenue from online content this fiscal year. That's a 43% jump from 2007. But the Mouse House continues to lose broadcast TV audiences, and their DVD sales are flat. Finally, studio execs can look at just about any tragedy and ask, how does this affect me? The Elliot Spitzer prostitution scandal is no exception. And no, it's not what you're thinking. Spitzer was working on a serious tax incentive to attract production to New York State. And with him gone, Hollywood's worrying that their tax break might go broke. The state legislature had agreed with Spitzer's incentives, which were capped at $100 million. But as Senator Martin Golden puts it, the New York Senate wants to, quote, blow the cap out. Given the current political climate, that just sounds like a bad idea. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later in the show, has the strike changed this TV season and seasons to come? But next, the video game business says, whee! Video games are now an $18 billion industry, and that's just in the U.S. And they're growing and changing fast. One of the biggest changes is the move towards what are now known as casual and social games. In 2007, casual games rang up $2.25 billion in revenue globally, and they're growing at a rate of 20% a year, according to the Casual Games Association. While the movie business may be four times bigger than casual video games are growing four times as fast. Okay, but what are casual video games? To find out, we sent our producer Matt Holzman to the West LA home of Steve Herbert, KCRW's chief engineer.
This is the future of gaming. A family in front of their flat-screen TV swinging their wireless controllers in the air in a heated match of virtual tennis. The Herberts, Steve, his wife Shirley, and their teenage boys are playing what is called a casual game, a game that's fun no matter how good you are.
So how do I actually hit the ball? I just swing.
You swing, okay. Swing and all right. You got to be prepared front to do hand and back hand.
I don't know.
Though the twins, Sam and Sean, and their older brother Scott certainly play on their own and with their friends, the whole clan gets together a lot. And according to Shirley, the family that plays together stays together.
That it's very social because everybody can talk and play and switch around and you're doing something together as a family.
The Herberts have the Nintendo Wii, the mega-hit video game box that's leading the gaming revolution into the casual and social future. Though millions and millions still play what are known as massively multiplayer online games like World of Warcraft, the future of gaming is actually in the past, when social games like Pong ruled the day. That was before video games became the dominion of socially awkward teenage boys who devote hours alone mastering the arcana of some alternate digital universe. In fact, Steve told me that last 4th of July, the family barbecue turned into an intergenerational video game tournament.
We had everybody over, and after about an hour or two, they turned this thing on. We had grandparents, you know, age 70, down to little kids age 7. They all wound up here. They all wound up playing for, like, the rest of the day together.
No one swam in the pool.
Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a good thing. It got everybody together, and they were all interacting and having a great time.
Is this sunny day?
Yeah.
Health and moral questions aside, Hollywood, which has largely missed the gaming boat, should be concerned about this important question.
Are you not going to the movies or watching TV because you're playing this thing?
No.
Not really.
Of anything, yeah, it's less TV.
Homework.
For the business, I'm Matt Holzman.
Oh, why did I know that was coming out of their mouth?
Now that we've all experienced a little casual gaming, we're going to talk about what they mean for the entertainment industry. Seth Chazelle is a reporter for the New York Times. He wrote a piece last month titled, As Gaming Turns Social, Industry Shifts Strategies. Seth Chazelle, welcome to the business.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Seth, give us the lay of the land in gaming right now. What are some of the real, you know, deal and personnel headlines of the last few months? It's been a very busy time in the land of video games.
I think what's happening is the industry is obviously growing incredibly quickly to about $18 billion combined hardware and software in the United States in 2007. And what you're really seeing, though, most broadly is that the parts of the industry that are growing the most quickly are really those where the companies are reaching out to a broader audience, not just to the same core young male demographic that had been sort of the foundation of the business for so many years. You're seeing companies like Nintendo with their Wii system, Activision with games like Guitar Hero, Blizzard with games like World of Warcraft, really reaching out to a broader demographic than the industry had reached before, and that's really where you're really seeing the growth. They want everyone to be a gamer. If you go back, you know, to the early 80s, to the dawn of video games, you know, video games were something that everyone did, and you did them in public, in arcades. And what happened over the course of the 80s is that gaming sort of retreated from the public sphere, and it became something that appealed much more to a niche audience. So now what you're seeing, though, with companies like Nintendo, games like Guitar Hero, is a sort of almost coming back to the roots of gaming and trying to make games that can appeal to everyone.
It's sort of the revenge against the revenge of the nerds.
I think that's right. And this idea that sort of play is important and, you know, people can interact in ways that, you know, are not violent really is sort of the future of where this industry is headed. And look, there will always be violent games, and there will be games for that hardcore audience, just like there are slasher movies. But the companies that have sort of stayed focused on that core young male demo are not growing as quickly. That's Sony, that's Microsoft, that's Electronic Arts. And you have seen some deal-making. Activision is merging with the games business of Vivendi of France, and the new company will be called Activision Blizzard. Blizzard is the name of the studio that makes Warcraft and Diablo and the StarCraft franchise. And now you've got Electronic Arts making an unsolicited hostile bid to take over Take-Two, the company that's best known for Grand Theft Auto. So those are some of the headlines right now.
Why are they so frisky? Why are we seeing all these consolidations going on? Is there something about the targeted companies that are in businesses they're not?
I think that's right. If you look at first at the Activision Blizzard deal, this company, Blizzard, in Irvine, in Southern California, I mean, they really are sort of the New York Yankees or the Boston Celtics of the video game business. They're really one of the top development studios. And this game, World of Warcraft, is making, you know, at least $1 billion a year now. It has 10 million subscribers around the world. Half of them are in China, actually. And so they've really identified this whole online social gaming phenomenon. And that's why they're so valuable to Activision.
I'm sorry, you did say $1 billion, right? That's sort of an astonishing.
That's billion with a B.
Yeah,
it's unbelievable when you think about it. The way these online games work is they're basically subscription based, and it's $15 a month usually. The business model is a little bit different in Asia, but you start doing the math on 10 million subscribers at $15 a month, you start to get some real money there. And like I said, what's interesting about it is that it's really been the growth of the business in Asia has been in online gaming, because there's so much piracy in Asia. It's really almost impossible to make a business selling software or even, you know, other sorts of intellectual property in Asia, because there is so much piracy. So what they've done, companies like Blizzard, they basically give the software away and then charge for the subscription. So it doesn't matter if you pirate the software. You're still paying them a monthly fee to have your subscription work.
Now, when you throw around figures like 250 million gamers and $1 billion worth of revenue and 500 million players worldwide, that has to get the attention of the major media conglomerates. Why hasn't Wall Street and the sort of corporate masters of Hollywood gotten wind of this? And why aren't we seeing Time Warner swallowing Activision? And why are we not seeing news corporations swallowing Electronic Arts?
Those things may very well happen. I think the history of Hollywood and video games is a fraught one. They've gotten it wrong a bunch of times. Traditionally, the way that Hollywood approached video games was, oh, well, we've got a Star Wars movie coming out, so we'll make a Star Wars game. We've got a pirate movie coming out, we'll make a pirate game. It was just very derivative. And you often saw the video games coming out of the merchandising departments of the studios, just like they're selling T-shirts or trading cards or something. And that's the wrong approach. And those games rarely were successful. I mean, The Matrix is a great example. And that's a franchise that should have led to some great games. And they messed it up, frankly, because the Hollywood studios just saw games as a marketing tie-in, not as their own business with their own way of telling stories and developing characters. If you look at what the top-selling games are generally, they're almost always original intellectual properties, not spin-offs of movies. So I think you've seen the Hollywood film studios, I mean, they have really struggled to figure out a way to get into gaming that isn't simply derivative. Disney is starting to do a good job with that, but Warner Brothers and some of the other studios have really had a tough time. Now, in terms of when you'll start seeing the news corporations and the Time Warners buying these companies, look, that very well can happen. But I think the ones that will be successful will be the ones that let the game companies stand on their own two feet and run their own business.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with New York Times reporter Seth Chazelle about how video games are growing and changing and how Hollywood seems to be missing the boat. So it seems like because Hollywood's not really owned or not really in the video game business, they sort of see it as a threat and as a kind of thing that people do instead of watching their television shows or instead of watching their movies. And if that's true, why hasn't the TV and movie business been able to leverage games to promote their products? Why not get in? If you can't beat them, join them kind of thing.
Well, first of all, you're right. The data is a little bit inchoate, but there's definitely a substitution effect going on out there. I mean, Hollywood's not doing great. TV viewership is flat to down. And video games are a big part of that. Now, I myself personally, I often watch TV while I'm playing a game on the computer. But for folks who are playing on a console like the Nintendo Wii or the PlayStation 3 or the 360, that's obviously on the television instead of actually watching a program and just using the TV as a monitor. In terms of the promotional aspects, there have been some attempts to do this. I think the biggest reason is that not every game fiction really lends itself to advertising Lost or Sex and the City movie or whatever it happens to be. And I think game companies have been somewhat sensitive to that. I mean, if you're talking about a fantasy universe of orcs and goblins and dragons, well, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, right, to have an ad for American Idol pop up. Now, but I think the pushback, I think, mostly has been from the game makers not wanting their players, who are, after all, paying $60 for these games, to feel like they're simply then just being marketed to for stuff that's not really relevant.
It sounds like that the inherent conflict here between video games and Hollywood isn't just that they see, in Hollywood, people see video games as competitive with their product. There's competing advertising models here. The way that Hollywood makes its money is to give the product away for free, and then you have to sit back and watch, beer commercials or whatever gets jammed in there.
I think gamers, they really are some of the most discerning consumers of media for a number of reasons. Number one, the financial commitment, right? I mean, what other media besides, opera or symphony are you paying $60 up front? For someone in high school or a younger person in college, $60 is a lot of money. And then it's a commitment to the product. It can take 20, 30 hours for some of these games. And you want to be able to get that value from it. And so if it's a very considered buying decision. People go to the movies and they say, well, I'm just going to go to the movies, and they don't even care what they're going to go see, right? I'll figure it out when I get there because it's a $10 or $20 commitment. For a gamer, they're often spending months in advance of these games coming out. There are previews and sneak peeks. And like I said, it's a very considered buying decision. And so it really is a different business model, but it's also a different way of telling stories dramatically, right? I mean, Hollywood's about marketing these stars that you sort of aspire to be. Are you sort of curious about their love lives or who's sleeping with who, or sort of this whole Hollywood gossip machine. And a game is really about putting the consumer in the center of the experience, right? The player is at the center, not some externalized star who's getting paid $20 million so you can go, ooh and ah over them for 90 minutes. So it really is a very different kind of experience. And look, I mean, California is the home of the video game industry, but you've seen it has been different skill sets and it has been different people, not just being able to transfer over. And look, you do have people like Steven Spielberg who's making a game. Traditionally those haven't worked, but I think you're starting to see an appreciation of that, and we'll see what Spielberg comes up with. Lucas has done some good games as well, but it really has to be approached on its own merits, and it's not simply taking a movie setting and letting you run around and shoot things, really.
Seth, I remember being a kid and in my happy, idyllic childhood, playing Life with my parents or playing Candyland or something like that. And on the cover of the game is a sort of idealized nuclear family all enjoying the spoils of life or whatever the game was. Are we seeing anything like that with video games as things get more and more casual? I mean, I'm not talking about people wearing Dockers.
Well, you're absolutely right. And the company that really identified this was Nintendo. And traditionally, video game advertisements were about showing the game, right? Screenshots. And what Nintendo has done with the Wii and with their DS handheld machine is instead of showing the games, they're showing the players. And you just see this in the art style. The ads are shot from the perspective of the television back out at these families, right? So you're seeing these, the people, the families, the young friends playing the game without actually seeing the game itself in the marketing, because that's what they're pitching, right? Is this is a social experience that you can have with a whole family, your whole group of friends, and everyone can enjoy them together. But you're absolutely right in terms of, once again, trying to, feminizing the boxes. Middle-aged women are actually the number one audience of these casual games, whether at home or in the office. And that's sort of, been underappreciated. So between that and what you're seeing from Nintendo, you're absolutely right in terms of marketing the games as a social experience rather than actually showing the product itself.
Now, Seth, we're almost out of time here, but it would be remiss of me if I didn't address the burning topic of just about everybody in Hollywood, which is Scrabulous. It's threatening productivity levels all over town.
That's good.
We're referring, of course, to the Scrabble-like game on Facebook, and it has Mattel and Hasbro threatening legal action against its founders. It seems like the same reaction the record companies had to peer-to-peer networks, but I'm wondering, have board game companies finally gotten the memo that the web exists and that this can be something for them?
You're starting to see that. The fact that Scrabulous exists is a failure on the part of the traditional board game companies. There's no doubt about it. They should have locked that up themselves. And the one thing I would say about that, it's going back to this sort of thought that we led with games, sort of casual games in the office, being a big driver of where the eyeballs are headed. You are seeing games there's been versions of Monopoly. The one that you're not seeing is poker, and that's actually the interesting one. You talk about sort of other games getting translated into video games. This online poker business is huge on PCs, and what you have not seen is the Sonys and the Microsofts being willing to sort of cross that legal Rubicon of allowing people to play poker for real money through the console systems. But the board game guys, they're trying to figure it out. But if you look at Scrabulous, you're right. It was a missed opportunity.
Well, we have to leave it there. Seth Chazelle writes about video games for the New York Times. Seth, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks for having me.
After a short break, has the writer's strike changed TV forever? You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. Former Seinfeld writer Peter Melman once observed that L.A. actually does have four seasons. Earthquake season, fire season, riot season, and the most ravaging, pilot season. Normally, pilot season is the time when networks buy hundreds of TV scripts to develop into dozens of pilot episodes. Only a handful of those, as they say, go to series. This year, because of the writer's strike, pilot season got morphed into a strange hybrid. For instance, NBC has ordered multiple episodes of a new show called Kath and Kim without ordering a pilot, like they normally would. And networks are talking about launching new series throughout the year, instead of unleashing a fall stampede that leaves lots of promising shows trampled to death. With $9 billion worth of advertising in the balance, networks are tampering with the tried and true, if somewhat arcane, way of making television. Lynette Rice covers the TV Sausage Factory for Entertainment Weekly. Lynette Rice, welcome to the business.
Pleasure to be here.
What effect did the Writers Guild of America strike have on pilot season this year? For instance, is it even happening?
It is happening, but just not in the way that it has happened in previous seasons. I mean, there are definitely pilots still being purchased, but there's also plenty more shows being ordered straight to series.
So what does it look like for next year? I mean, was this such a transformative event that pilot season as we know it isn't really going to happen again? And why would that be?
Well, there are plenty of execs who think that this is actually a good thing for the business because when development season would roll around, there would be so many scripts purchased and so many pilots, you know, so many examples of studios, you know, throwing things against the wall, hoping something will stick. So the quality after a while just really kind of blew. And so now that there are fewer shows being developed, the thought is, you know, you're working from a smaller talent pool, so the chances are better that you would have a success, kind of like what the cable networks have done for years. You know, they don't put all their eggs in a basket. You know, they pretty much develop a show one at a time. I mean, we're not seeing that with the networks. They can't afford to develop a show one at a time. But if they're developing fewer projects, then perhaps they'll have a greater chance of success because they're putting more of their energy into fewer projects.
But if you go straight to series on a pilot, let's say, there's a sort of a less of a diversity of product to offer people. Are networks sort of, you know, less responsive now to an audience? Do they have to sort of grit their teeth and say, well, we made our bed, we're going to sleep in it?
Well, that's a very cynical way to look at it. I mean, you could all, from the more optimistic way to look at it, because they're committing to this project as opposed to throwing a bunch of crappy pilots against the wall, that can be a good thing because, you know, they're putting you know, all their energy into this project. You know, it takes a long time for a show to really get an audience. It's part of history now that it took a long time for Seinfeld to really connect with viewers. And, you know, people don't jump on board the first week, and sometimes it takes them a full year. So if the networks are committing to fewer projects, that can be a good thing for us at home. I mean, viewers complain all the time that networks, you know, air two and out, and that's it. I mean, it's like, dude, I barely got even a chance to memorize the title, and you've already canceled the show. So it is a good thing for the audience if the networks develop fewer shows and put more money and energy into these fewer projects. That's a good thing.
So those are the advantages. What are the disadvantages to, say, getting rid of pilots and just saying, we're going to put this on the air?
Well, the disadvantage of doing what's called, you know, ordering straight to series, and that's just not just, you know, ordering a pilot and then making the pilot and then deciding from there whether this thing is good for a series. They're just, you know, putting the money up and saying, okay, we're committing to this. Now, granted, they can always pull out. Let's say, for example, you know, Fox ordered the next show from Joss Whedon that stars Eliza Dushku. I mean, they're reunited from their Buffy days. There's a chance that Joss is going to turn in a script that completely sucks. So if that comes, then they can say, okay, that show that we said that we were going to pick up to series, we're not going to do it. But they're going to have to pay a huge penalty because of that. So the downside of it is, you know, they're already putting up a lot of money, and there's a chance that even if it's like a great name like a Joss Whedon or even a Jerry Bruckheimer, there's a very good chance that what is delivered come September is not going to be what the audience ordered.
Mm-hmm. So if Aaron Sorkin delivers Studio 61 on the Gaza Strip or something
right,
like that, and you order six episodes – you know, you're kind of screwed if it doesn't take off.
Yeah, I mean, by tradition, it's probably a better gamble to go with a well-known name like an Aaron Sorkin or a Jerry Bruckheimer. But the flip side of that is, you know, these guys don't always hit it out of the ballpark. And the other thing, too, and there's a big concern in town as well, is that when you bank on the same old big names, you lose the chance of going after the next Josh Schwartz, you know, the guy who brought us the OC, or the next Ryan Murphy, the guy who brought us Nip Tuck, or even the next Sean Ryan, the guy who brought us The Shield. I mean, these guys they developed spec scripts long ago that somebody took a gamble on, and now there's a chance that they may not do that because the networks want, since they're developing fewer projects, they want to go with a sure thing. They want to go with a Joss Whedon.
Mm-hmm. So what shows are not making it back because of the strike?
Well,
that's kind of a speculative question, I realize, because it's sort of asking, you know, what killed them? Was it the hamburgers or the cigarettes?
Well, it's funny because the strike actually helped shows that were on the bubble because there was less development going on, less new scripts coming into the pipeline. It forced the networks to maybe, you know, give a second look at shows that were kind of on the bubble. Now, shows like Kane or Journeyman, we won't see them come back.
Now, those are CBS shows that were sort of struggling.
Journeyman is NBC. Kane was CBS. I mean, they were already struggling. You know, other shows like Dirty Sexy Money, the critics loved it, but it wasn't pulling the ratings.
I need your help. Certainly they're better equipped lawyers than me.
I trust you. You're the guy.
Trip, I just don't think it's a good fit.
I'll give you $5 million a year to do all your little charitable projects.
I'd have to do it my own way.
Hey, one man wouldn't.
I'd have to keep regular hours.
You keep whatever hours you want.
And I'd never lie for the family.
We would never ask you to.
$10 million.
Done.
You know, that show, you know, maybe got like a second lease that, you know, okay, well, you know, maybe we'll relaunch this show. Now, granted, some of the networks will say when you use the word relaunch, that's like code for, okay, danger. A show like that, it's going to come back. It's going to get a new push. And, you know, maybe the strike helped it. Maybe the fact that there wasn't a lot of development out there, it helped the show survive. Probably a bigger example is ER. I mean, this show has been around since the dawn of TV. And if it were to come back, it would be its 15th season, which is just extraordinary. I mean, John Wells doesn't need any more money. Warner Brothers doesn't need any more money from this show. I mean, they've sold it, you know, a bazillion times in syndication. But because there wasn't that much development for NBC, and ER wasn't doing badly, thanks to John Stamos, suddenly after the strike was over, they were thinking, well, let's not get too hasty. Perhaps we can consider yet another bloody season of this show. And so they are negotiating as we speak, and that show will be back.
So, Lynette, what are some of the trends of the new shows going forward for next season? Comedy, drama, that sort of thing.
Thanks to Lost, there certainly is continued interest in the mythology, the conspiracy stories. There are a couple of dramas in the works about secret government agencies. I think that viewers have demonstrated that they really are into the serialized show. They want the serialized show. You know, we got stuck with so many procedurals for so long. It's like, you know, you can't keep us hanging from week to week from here on out. And the networks seem to be answering that.
Well, we got to leave it there. Lynette Rice is senior writer for Entertainment Weekly. Her article, Pilots Take Flight, appears in the latest issue of EW. Lynette, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.